Uh-oh, the last cookie.
You can get a new box of cookies in as fast as an hour with Walmart Express delivery.
Are you my guilty self-conscious?
No, I'm the voice offering you promo code EXPRESS for free delivery on your first order.
Hey, who ate my cookies?
You mean, these cookies?
Order now. Welcome to your Walmart. Promotion valid for first express delivery order. $50 minimum subject to availability. Restrictions apply.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.
Is out now. Not alone that, it has just gone to number one in the charts. The story is about a fictional character, Contessa Giovanna Landi, based in part on the true story of Princess Nina Pallavicini, who risked everything to help escaped prisoners make it to safety while under threat from the Gestapo. Now, Joe O'Connor's with me now. Joe, good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Pat. Lovely to see you.
Now, I remember reading something about you saying you didn't like historical fiction much.
Well, I can't have a theory that only people who don't like a genre should be allowed to write in it, you know. So Bram Stoker wasn't a huge fan of Gothic fiction until he started writing it and so on, because I think it gives you a kind of fresh perspective. So there's a particular kind of historical novel which is so researched that it begins to feel more like a lecture than a, you know, a page turning novel, and that's what I'm not a fan of.
You're not a fan of that. But also at the end of your book you say, do not use this book as historical research into what happened in Rome, because that's not what it is.
Yeah, so it's The Ghost of Rome is a novel first and last, and it is kind of inspired by some real people and real events, as its predecessor My Father's House was, particularly the character of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, this remarkable man from Kishkeem in County Cork, but brought up in Killarney, became a Catholic priest, went to live in Rome, mainly for reasons of study. He was a very scholarly man, Hugh, and he achieved 3 PhDs in the course of his life. So he's a man of thought and a man of prayer, but he finds himself in Rome as the Nazis attack and conquer Italy, and he puts together this escape line to help people who are fleeing.
This is a matter of interest, which is not really relevant. Was he a golfer, in fact?
He was, yes.
He was a golfer,
His dad was a golf professional in Killarney, and Hugh was a very good amateur golfer, and in fact, before the war, played golf often with Sir Francis Darcy Osborne, the British ambassador to the Vatican, who also appears as a character.
Now, you have some characters who are real and other characters who are based on perhaps real figures, but not one and the same.
Yeah, so my way of explaining this part is to say they're all fictional. I mean, even the characters in the book who have the same names as real life people are my imagining of them. There's a man called John May who appears in the book, who was a real person, a manservant at the British Embassy. But I don't know anything about him other than his name. And I've, to all the research, I've only found one photograph of him. So I've invented this life for Johnny May. The other fact I knew is that he was a Cockney. He's from the East End of London, a place I have an affection for, and for how people talk there. So Johnny May was a real, you know, the name of a real man, but his portrayal in the book is fictional. It's a novel.
Now, the Countess, again, is a fictional person. She's central to the whole novel in this case. She was partly based on this other person I mentioned, Princess Nina Pallavicini.
Yeah. So one of the things that struck me while I was writing the previous book, which is My Father's House, about a third of the way in, I began to think that the women involved in this story were really important. And while I couldn't deal with that in a central way in the first book, that I would in The Ghosts of Rome. So women from every class and every background, from housewives, waitresses, teachers to noble women, all participated in this effort. And this remarkable woman, Princess Nina Pallavicini, became a forger for Hugh O'Flaherty's escape line. So there's an element of her, there's an element of some other women. Again, she's a fictional creation.
Now, the Nazi in question, Paul Hauptmann, is not real, but based on someone who you don't even want to grace with, if you like, an appearance.
Well, in real life, Hugh's kind of cat and mouse relationship with the Gestapo boss of Rome is an interesting one, but I suppose I didn't want to portray them as equals or equivalents. I mean, Hugh O'Flaherty is a remarkably courageous, heroic man. I didn't really want to commemorate the other fella. And also, I suppose just the technical thing, Pat, in writing the novel, I wanted the Nazi character to do things that I
that
know
the, other fella
the original
do.
Man yeah. did not do. So I thought I would change the name for that, for those reasons, yeah.
Mm. Now, the escape line and the group of people behind it, the choir, as you dubbed them, was that real, the choir?
No, that wasn't real.
That's
no. This is The Ghosts of Rome, My Father's House, are novels, you know, first and last. But I suppose that was my way of dramatising the collective effort.
Yeah.
But like, rather than describe how they worked very closely together, if you think about how a choir works, it can only work by people agreeing, you know, I'll sing the opening 16 bars and then I'll go quiet and you sing the next four bars and then we'll all sing the end together. Yeah. So it was a way of dramatising their remarkable trust and affection for each other. And the fact that, you know, the greatest things that we do are done collaboratively. I mean, that's true of musicians as well as activists.
Uh-oh, the last cookie.
You can get a new box of cookies in as fast as an hour with Walmart Express delivery.
Are you my guilty self-conscious?
No, I'm the voice offering you promo code EXPRESS for free delivery on your first order.
Hey, who ate my cookies?
You mean these cookies?
Order now. Welcome to your Walmart. Promotion valid for first express delivery order. $50 minimum subject to availability. Restrictions apply.
Now, earlier on in the program, we were talking about Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List and Oscar Schindler and how many lives he saved. He wished he could have saved more. How many lives did Hugh O'Flaherty and his group actually save?
Well, their work was done in secret, and so it depends which historian you read, but it may have been up to 7,000 escaped Allied prisoners of war. So, I mean, there are many, many people alive today in the world because of the work of this little group of seven or eight, very diverse people. It was one of the remarkable things about the story is that Hugh did not put together a group of eight Catholic priests. They're women and men, people of all faiths and no faith, just united by their affection for the city of Rome and their desire to do something to help people fleeing from the tyranny.
And the reason there were so many Allied prisoners at large, what was happening in the war that allowed that to happen? Where were they escaping from?
Well, so the main thing, the main factor in just the sheer numbers was the fact that Italy changed sides in the war some months before this.
Yeah.
And in many cases, the Italian concentration camp guards just threw down their weapons and went home.
At this point, Mussolini was dead?
No, he wasn't.
He was still at large?
He was, yeah. But in some cases, people flooded out of the prisoner of war camps. In some cases, everybody left. So suddenly you had 200 and 300 and 500 men roaming through the countryside, not quite sure where they were going. But word got out that if you could somehow make it to St. Peter's Square in the Vatican, because the Vatican State was a neutral country, and that this Irish priest might be able to save you.
And the idea that it was sacred territory, and I mean that in the political, diplomatic sense rather than the religious sense, that you stepped inside that sanctuary, the Nazis would not chase you.
Well, that was the hope. I mean, it was a neutral country, the Vatican State.
Even though it's tiny.
It's tiny. It's 1/6 of a square mile, but it became a neutral state in 1929. And I suppose the hope in the Vatican was that the Nazis would respect that. There was also a great, great fear that they wouldn't. And one of the reasons why Hugh got a lot of opposition from the kind of papal and Vatican authorities was that people felt he would be compromising neutrality, and they did not want the Panzer tanks rolling into St. Peter's Square and the swastika flying from the Vatican Museum. So he was getting opposition from the Nazis, from the papacy and from the government back in Dublin, who are extremely concerned that Irish neutrality will be compromised by this.
And this is where Delia Murphy comes in, who was in real life married to the Irish minister to the Vatican, who nowadays would be the ambassador.
Yes, he's just technically his status was not yet ambassador. I think possibly because the British had an ambassador, so we decided we'd call ours something else. So Delia is a very well-known singer. married to Thomas Kiernan, living in Rome, absolutely should not have been involved in this escape line. But she was a really heroic, courageous character who put herself and probably her marriage at risk.
And Irish diplomatic relations with the Vatican at risk if she had been caught and implicated in this escape line.
Yeah, it would have been a very serious problem. But I think, you know, the thing about the people in The Ghosts of Rome is that although they're heroic and they're very brave, they're also flawed and they have mixed motives. And I think in Delia's case, part of it was just a kind of stubbornness. And with Hugh, I think that the disapproval that he received from the papal authorities, I think he might have agreed with. You know, I've had the privilege of reading all of his surviving manuscripts and letters and stuff through the graciousness of his family. They've allowed me look at all this. And the man who emerges is very likable. He loves sport and music and his friends. But he's kind of conservative, old-fashioned, obedient priest. He's not a kind of Father Trendy. He's not a liberation theologian. But I just think he had a moral compass that he was not able to stop his work. I think it was a streak of stubbornness, and it may have been the Kerry in him, Pat.
Yeah. The question of the character of Delia Murphy, which comes across in the book, I mean, stroppy, difficult, wild.
Oh, you didn't want to get on her bad side.
How much do you know of that to be true? And her daughter, described as beautiful and also typical late teenager, rebellious.
Well, I researched it a bit, and there are interviews with Delia Murphy online about other subjects. She didn't talk about this much, but of course it is a fictional portrayal. I did have a moment 2 years ago for the launch of My Father's House. There's a public event and there are questions at the end. And out of the darkness, I heard a voice saying, well, I'm a nephew of Delia Murphy, and I knew Delia very well, so I thought, oh my God, here goes. But thank God, he said, and I think you've captured her. You know, I think that's exactly how she did talk. So yeah, she is kind of mouthy, obstreperous, you know, didn't take any nonsense from anyone. Also capable of great charm, a very important musician. John Kelly, great music man, was telling me recently that in 1940s Ireland, Delia Murphy was kind of the biggest, nearest thing we had to a pop star. She didn't just do ballad sessions over pubs. She did concert tours and, you know, recorded albums. Delia was singing in the opera house in Belfast on the night that the Luftwaffe bombed the theatre. And as she later went on to describe, that's what you call a mixed review, she said. But there's great stories of her leading the audience out into the street and singing to them all night to keep their spirits up. So she is an amazing woman, and it was she's a lovely character to spend time with.
Now, the city of Rome is very much a character in the book as well. You spend some hard-working time there,
yes,
researching the book.
Yes, I did. I'm willing to suffer for my art, Pat. So over the last 3 years, I suppose we've spent 8 months in Rome, and we usually stay in the same part of it, a neighbourhood called Trastevere, which is a lovely old part of the city that really hasn't changed much since the time of The Ghosts of Rome. It's little alleyways and back streets and shadowy, very atmospheric. So it's nice to be able to walk the same streets as that the people in the escape line walked, and to have that sense of the living history of Rome. Mussolini in the 20s tore down a lot of the city and rebuilt bits of it, but since the 30s, large neighbourhoods of Rome haven't changed at all.
And this prompts my next question, because reading the book, I didn't realise there was so much Allied bombing of the Eternal City. I mean, the idea, you know, the way the Nazis, and for self-interested reasons on the part of the commander in Paris, it didn't get destroyed, the Nazis. I think it was Hitler wanted to visit and maybe model Berlin on elements of Paris. But the Allies seemed to bomb Rome, and whether they were careful about the Colosseum and the Vatican.
I think they were. I think it was targeted bombing. But I suppose it's a particular phase in the war, Pat. My Father's House is Christmas 1943. Yeah. The new book, The Ghosts of Rome, is kind of the spring of 1944. The Allies have landed in Italy. Nobody knows for sure whether that's true. We now know, looking back. But the Allies are 50 kilometres down the road from Rome. So I think there was a desperation that we'll be as careful as we can, but we will absolutely bombard Rome, because it's going to be a key part of winning the war. So it was very bloody. There's a lot of propaganda on both sides. There's no BBC news. There's no 24-hour news cycle. So rumours are rife. It was very interesting reading some of the letters, how food is weaponized. You know, food by the spring of 1944 is very scarce, and you've accounts of people falling down and dying of hunger in the streets of Rome because the Nazis are controlling the black market, and if there's any sign of opposition, they'll just switch the water off and confiscate all the food. So it's a very kind of febrile atmosphere by the time you get to that point in the war.
This is book two of three.
Yes.
So what happens next?
Well, I'm not going to tell you what happens next, but I do have 60,000 very rough words of the third book written. And in the same way that the Contessa Landini is the central character of The Ghosts of Rome, the man I mentioned earlier, Johnny May, will be the protagonist of book three. I'm looking forward to having some more time to go back and work on that.
A great excuse.
Exactly, yeah.
Joe, thank you very much for joining us. The Ghosts of Rome is out now. As I say, it's just hit number one in the charts. It's a terrific book. The second of three. If you haven't read the first one, you don't have to read the first one first.
No.
You can read this one and then, if you like, go back to the second one.
Yeah.
Joe, thank you very much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.